You study relentlessly, every hour fueled by fear of seeing the big 4-0, that 40% again on the face of your class test. Now, sleep is becoming optional. Meals are becoming forgotten. One day, your mind just stops. Burnout silently arrives and steals the show and your drive. How do you recover when your greatest strength, your determination, starts to break you? We are joined once again by none other than Naira Mutala, CASA, Chief Operating Officer and Director at Ascension Capital Partners, a majority black-owned private equity fund manager headquartered in Pretoria. We discussed this time round how you can avoid the infamous burnout and make sure that you can last through your accounting journey. We also chat about the value that investors bring other than money, proprietary deal flow and networking in private equity, value creation versus value capture, the scale of sacrifice and meaning, sleep's importance for your productivity and learning, and more. Once again, I hope you enjoy. What's up, my travelers on the road? We are carrying on once again with Private Equity Month this March, where we chat about all things private equity. If you are not aware of what private equity is, I highly recommend part one. It'll be linked in the show notes where we explore exactly what this thing is called private equity. Just a quick disclaimer before the episode today, there's no medical advice. We do chat about a few things that could potentially help you along your journey, but by no means are these any type of advice. They are simply just our explorations of health-related topics and how we approach our lives. With that, please do check out part one and on to part two. The idea of smart money versus dumb money. I love it because I think it's an idea that I want to draw to around the value that you provide being more than capital. Because I think there's this misconception in South Africa, or I guess just maybe it's a general misconception, that investment, the whole investment realm is just about money. What would you say is, if you could condense it down, the value that you provide?
I think money is one aspect, but I think, your choice of partner, you know, it can determine a lot.
It can be the same amount of money. In fact, it could be more money in the one.
Like, I think I'm sure there's shows like Dragon's Den and what's the Shark Tank and stuff where the investors are like trying to, if there's a good opportunity, they're trying to convince the entrepreneur why they should partner with them. Because it's more than money. Like, part of that is, you know, networks. What is the breadth of your networks? Like, networks is incredibly valuable in what you bring. What is your expertise? What is, you know, it comes down to the team that you're partnering with. What are, you know, your capabilities? Like, how driven are you? It comes down to the softer things. Like, what value can this partner add?
People.
Yeah, people. What access do they have to the right knowledge, skills? What skills do they bring? What can propel a business further?
It gets into this idea that you're going to explain again as the expert. This is not financial advice, by the way.
We need to add that disclaimer.
By the way, proprietary deal flow. What is that? And can you just share with us a little bit about, you know, in the private equity sense, what it is?
Okay, so proprietary deal flow is, let me start with the opposite of that. Okay. For example, if a business is for sale, then maybe they partner with an investment banking firm or a corporate finance advisor, and then they market the business to various counterparties. So it's like an auction process. So they will target various buyers, and it's a auction process where, you know, you due diligence the business, you put in bids, and it becomes almost like a bit of a pricing war. So that's the opposite end of the spectrum. A proprietary deal flow would almost be a deal that you can identify in your network that's not known to others. And you find that through your own networks. For example, the people you know at banks, or people that you know in the industry, the uncle you chat to at a braai. There's no science to deal flow. But yeah, your breadth of your networks, number of people, and depth of relationships. Creates that word.
I actually want to write that. So breadth of network, number of people, depth of relationships.
Yeah, depth as well.
So I would say like your quantity and your quality. Exactly. I would say the quantity and quality. And I want to also get, because I love the way that it's actually an art, because, you know, everyone wants the science part of it, but I feel like the art part of things is, it's just about connecting with who you are, because there's so much already in you. And if you can learn to connect with that through your designation, you're going to find that when you're getting into, you know, private equity, you are the king of proprietary deal flow because you know yourself.
And that's the art. And that's why there are various private equity firms out there, and they all have their own proprietary, you know, deals.
Yeah.
It just comes down to the people.
Yeah, it comes down to the people. And what would you say are some of the keys or in, I guess, in your experience, those, I guess I'll say, keys to proprietary deal flow?
So it's just actually having an inquisitive mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think you've met one of our team members at Ascension, Tiniko.
Yeah.
She's very good at just looking at and observing the world around her, being curious about businesses. And she doesn't hesitate to go to the front desk of a business that looks interesting and ask for a meeting.
That is, yeah, that's
like that's hunting. Yeah, she's really, really good at hunting. There's no limit. And I think you and I had a conversation earlier about, you were mentioning, you know, look at the fire hydrant on the wall and be like, no, there must be some company or business that's involved. Or look at, you can look at the world around you, and it's just being curious and just hunting, and also just connecting with your network. So like, even for people at your stage of life, your peers are the start of your network. Do you not know that? Like, the people you went to school with, the people you grew up with, the people who you are friends with at university. This is your network. These are the people that grow with you, and the relationships and friendships you form. That's how it all starts.
I think it's because networks are, it's a little bit of an icky word.
It is.
it sort of feels like you're objectifying the people, but let's take the stigma away. You know, because a network is literally someone you know.
Yeah.
It's someone you know.
Yeah.
And I love that you said quality as well, because it's also the people you know well and that you like.
Exactly. You can go to a conference and meet 100 people or 200 people that day, and if you just, you know, you just said hi and you didn't really, you know, get into any connection with that person, they're going to forget you, and you're not actually that important in their life.
But there's a very interesting sort of perspective that I've been thinking about. You know the saying, it's not about what you know, it's about who you know. It's a networking saying, I guess. But I think there's something missing around that, like a whole other side to it. Yes, it's not about what you know, it's about who you know. But also, and I'm finding increasingly, it's also about who knows you. Because the value of those people that are, even if they're shallow sort of connections in your network, it's actually multiplied by the value of the people that know you. By the, firstly, if let's say you are famous, for an example, you're a celebrity, firstly, you've already got the subscriber or the follower clout that says, this person is verified, you know, there's a verification on Instagram, for an example. But even beyond that, There's also further associations. So now this gets into brand, where if you are wanting to be, let's say for an example, you want to become the face of sports in Africa. Now, if you make sure that, or rather, if you know this guy who is, if you know Lionel, or let me think of an African footballer. If you know Sadio Mane, who's at Liverpool, and you guys go for coffee every week, you are immediately going to become that person that you want to become. Mm. And additionally, obviously, as I've already mentioned, other people will trust you more because Sadio Mane. I trust Sadio Mane. I'm going to trust you too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another example is, for example, your podcast, mm-hmm. where I feel like listening to people's podcasts, you feel it's like a one-sided kind of relationship, but you kind of get a sense of who that person is without the other person knowing you. There's a sense of familiarity. So if someone who listened to your podcast met you for the first time, you're not starting from a blank canvas. There's that extra, you know, depth of familiarity, which then already you've already moved further along in your relationship by virtue of that.
Do you know how powerful that is, though? Like, now that I'm thinking about it, so for an example, I prepare for most meetings that I'll enter. Like the one that we just had now, like I prepared, I made sure to research people in the room. That was my way of sort of preparing the ground, making sure that the fields are fertile for obviously the interaction we had, to make sure that people like me and that I like you, because familiarity, that already, it already makes you more likable, makes interactions far better. But when someone knows you, that's also a form of fertilizing the fields.
Yeah, no, and you're actually making me think of that, because initially I was just thinking of it as, you know, the old fashioned, you know, relationship building.
Mm.
But you've got a very, very valid point, and I don't think we use it enough. I don't think businesses use it enough. Mm. Just to put ourselves out there, but more that, yes, you might not have relationships with like that many people, but if you put yourself out there on various platforms, they get to know you and build familiarity. Mm. And when you eventually meet that person, you know, you're not starting from scratch.
Yeah.
You've got this, you know, you've got something to work with.
You've already made progress without knowing it.
Yeah.
But I think it really comes down to, Naira, short-term versus long-term incentive. I think a lot of the problems we have can be boiled down to choosing the short-term goal. It's like, because I think people, they view sort of meeting new people as a chore because they're not going to immediately get from that relationship. And that's why I have this saying that I say with my family all the time, never network hungry. Because the moment you do that, you get into this short-term mind and you get into this very desperate, very deprived, very selfish mind, because when you're hungry, you need this guy. You need that opportunity. Yeah. But if you're fine, if you are satisfied yet eager.
And just curious.
Mm-hmm. That's where the fields become fertile. And you don't even know that tomorrow, next year, 10 years time, you're going to plant a seed that's going to grow into something great.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you already know that I hate the word networking.
Yeah.
I hate like anything that sounds like networking. But
it's a little icky.
But it's weird that I hate the word networking, yet I love building meaningful connections with humans.
Mm.
You know, that's all that, you know, that's what I live for. I love building meaningful connections with humans.
Mm.
And I think it's important to not always want something from someone. I think, the best and most genuine relationships is when you're not expecting or wanting something from someone.
Yeah. How do you think like we have more of that? Because, we live in a country where there's a lot of lack. It's a tough one. But like, where do you think being being satisfied begins.
Sure. Is this a deep question?
It's pretty deep because, like, I really think being satisfied yet eager is that's the disposition, man. That's where you want to be.
Mm.
Yeah.
Sure. Maybe can you rephrase the question? I'm not sure I understand.
Do you think there's anything we can do to be less deprived and to network less but build more meaningful connections? To be of that spirit of building connections and not networking. Do you think there's things we can do, or what do you think?
Yeah, sure. That's a hard one to answer because from my perspective, I don't like being the salesman or the person that's wanting something from someone. I don't know if it's personality traits. I don't know. Like for me, it's not in my nature to be like that. So that's why I'm finding it difficult to answer that question. But if I had to throw it back to you, what do you think?
I love that you said nature, because I think there are salespeople. There are natural born salespeople, people that are more inclined towards the thing. Although sales is a skill, it's not that you can't do it. But I think this is tough, man. This one we will think about.
Yeah, it's I think just continued. Awareness of it. I think if maybe a person, awareness. Yeah, yeah. If a person just has awareness and realizes, no, don't just go, you know, trying to get something out of someone. Just look at the human in front of you and connect with the person in front of you. That's what it's about. Not wondering and weaving to find out what can this person do for me. That's never how a good network will ever help you in life.
Because like today, what I see everywhere is the rulers, the kings, the queens, the killers. They are servants. It is crazy. They are servants of the people. The people that run things are the most selfless. How crazy! Yeah. So it's like. I just think so. I have this other idea of it's a sort of a mental model of value creation versus value capture. And I really also believe that the more we can just focus on creation and less on capture, the more everything, as well as yourself, gets better. Because, you know, like I even think about this podcast for an example. If you focus on capture, what you're missing is the thing that you have to create, which enables capture.
Yeah.
And that is the thing. Like, you know, even money, it's such a big idea. But money, it's also this misunderstood thing because we think money is valuable. It's not. Money is not value. It's a representation. It's our representation of value.
Yeah.
And therefore, we need to start at value. Before we even think about money.
Yeah.
We need to get better before we get rich. Yeah. We need to get better before we get famous.
Yeah.
But we need to just focus on the giving. That's my, I don't know if it's a contrarian view.
No, I like that view. No, the giving. And also, like, as you're saying, you know, money, it's so crazy. It's just, it's numbers on a screen. That's all it is right now in today's day and age. It's not anything except a number on a screen.
It's a number.
Like, imagine if something happened in the universe and then, like, the whole earth had, like, a glitch and then all computer systems, like, wiped out and then, like, the money that you had that was just on a screen gets wiped out.
Where's it?
Yeah.
It's gone.
Exactly.
It's so funny because even, like, so I have been, like, doing a little bit of research around, like, the financial markets and just, the like, the financialization of the world, it's so interesting. Like, how did paper money come about? You know how the dollar used to be backed by gold? Where did it go? Because now the dollar's backed by what? Debt. where does money come from? Yeah. And I feel like that's like not my problem. I think your problem is creating value. That's my thing.
I agree.
What I remember you mentioned last time, but you're gonna tell us now, what are some of the top lessons that you've learned throughout your career? I don't know if you have them written down, But like, let's say, what are your top five lessons from your career? You can go back to those ones that we chatted about.
Sure, I can just reflect on some of my experiences. Mm. And unfortunately, sometimes when you can, even when you share experiences, I sometimes think lessons need to be learned through your own experience. Because if someone even told me about certain things to watch out for before, and people actually did when I was going through it, but I actually had to go through it the hard way. Sometimes the only way to learn things is hard lessons.
Yeah, but it's nice. It's like pre-reading.
It's like pre-reading.
And then you made the mistake. You're like, okay, I knew, so I'm not going to do it this time.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So the first thing or challenge that I faced in my career is burnout. Mm-hmm. I experienced that about twice in my career. Yeah. After the first time, I actually said, this will never happen again. And then a few years later, it happened again.
See, maybe pre-reading would have helped there.
How it all went down is, you know, I was in an investment banking firm. And the reason why I burnt out is because it's quite a unforgiving environment, a very, I would say maybe describe it as a cutthroat environment. So it wasn't just a combination of like late hours. It was the combination of very long hours paired with extreme pressure where you can't make a single mistake and the volume of work would be insane. Mm. So for example, if you left at say 8 p.m. at night, it would mean you have capacity. Mm. Yeah. So you need to be working around the clock. All your awake hours need to be spent working.
Yeah.
It was very tough. I did that for a few years and it takes a toll on you physically, mentally, the relationships you have. You're unable to live a life outside of work. Mm. You'd eat all your meals at work.
That's a recipe for burnout.
Yeah. But at the same time, I also don't regret the experience because, you know, especially when I started back then, I had youth on my side. I was very ambitious. Mm. There's a lot I wanted to learn. And yes, I got an insane amount of experience through that decision and working in that environment. Mm. So I got to see a lot of exciting and thrilling things.
Yeah.
It did come with a cost.
Mm.
But then after I had experienced that and, you know, I lost a lot of things that were important to me, you know, you know, your health and a lot of important things.
Yeah.
I knew that I didn't want that to happen again. And unfortunately, then I found myself in a career and a like an environment where it was happening again. Mm. And then I actually realized, no, I need to take responsibility for this. Mm. It's not just happening to me. I also have, you know, a hand in this. Like, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
A lot of it, I think, you know, I've always been trying to prove myself.
Mm.
I think also when you're young, you know, natural. You know, it's natural. Yeah. You always want to be doing challenging things and proving yourself, you know, to the world, for someone to acknowledge you that, you know, you're good. Mm. After the second time, after it happened again, you know.
Okay, I'm done.
Yeah. I actually learned, you know, that it's actually part of it could be what's in my control. Mm. You know, even after that point, I even thought I should exit this industry.
Sure.
And I actually took a year where.
Oh, wow.
I didn't start riding horses, but I did it full time. I became a student at the South African Lipizzaners.
Oh, wow.
It's an NPO.
Oh, wow.
It's basically the ballet of the White Stallions. So I did that student program where I got my equestrian qualifications. I qualified as a rider. We did public performances weekly.
Sure.
And that came, you know, that was a beautiful experience. Mm. I do recommend, you know, everyone in their life and, you know, to take a step away from what you do as your job.
Ride a horse, man.
Yeah, just live your passion for some time. Take a step away. Mm. And after that year, sure, I learned a lot. It was a very difficult year. Mm-hmm. So it was difficult in other ways. Like, it was difficult because I was fearing for my life. We're working with stallions. Things are dangerous.
Yeah.
People are falling. You know, we have different problems and it's very hard work, but now it's manual labor.
You
know? Yeah. Sure. So I learned a lot of things, but then I knew I definitely didn't want to do that as my career or job, like being in the equestrian industry. I'd rather keep that as a hobby and a passion. And then I found myself coming back into the industry. But I came with a different perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew a bit better what I wanted and what I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And coming to the Sentient team, it was, you know, the people made the biggest difference.
Mm.
Yeah, the team that I'm working with are incredible. Like our CEO, Kabelo Moja, what a leader. He's I have the highest level of respect for him. That is an incredible leader.
Mm. No, he's a phenomenal guy.
Yeah.
I've met him. He's a phenomenal guy. So burnout. I remember hearing that one of the sort of like in the scientific study of burnout, one of the key conditions of burnout is not having adequate motivation, i.e. not being intrinsically motivated by the thing that you're doing. So it's when there isn't equal meaning to the amount of sacrifice that you are giving. So I'm thinking about it in this other sort of mental model that I have of like it's called the scale of sacrifice and meaning. Basically, if you can just picture these scales, right? So on the one side, you have meaning. Say on the right side, guys, for all those listeners out there. And on the left side, you have sacrifice. So in this instance, you have what's called futility, i.e. that feeling of emptiness, that feeling of nothingness. That is where, on the right side, meaning, it's very high. And on the left side, sacrifice is very low, i.e. there's very little meaning and there's loads of sacrifice, or there's not enough. And in that case, it's when you are working for something that doesn't mean a lot to you, that is one of the preconditions for burnout. And the other side is cognitive dissonance. The equal side is eudaimonia, but maybe this is a topic for another day. But that scale is how I think of it. What would you say? Like, would you say that was one of the things that you were giving so much and there wasn't sort of the requisite recognition, the requisite satisfaction or meaning behind it? Or was it just simple physical? No,
I wouldn't say that. Like, if I could have managed, I would have stayed and continued.
Okay.
It's just the cost of it was too great. There was nothing that, you know, once your mental health, your physical health and everything in your life takes a toll.
Yeah.
Is anything worth it in the long term?
Mm.
Is there anything? So anything that can give you the ultimate meaning, but that costs you your well-being, would that ever make sense?
That's a good question.
Yeah, you can do it for the short term, but long term, it's not a deal you'd want to enter into.
Mm. But I mean, like, wouldn't Jeff Bezos do that for Amazon? I don't know, you know?
Yeah, but for
how long? Not me. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. Not me.
Yeah. You just have, I guess, it's very personal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very personal. And what I may decide might not be what another person decides. Yeah, and maybe it is a fair deal for someone else.
Mm.
But me personally, it wasn't. It wasn't a deal that was going to work.
Mm.
And then I think after I experienced burnout the second time and then also had a step away where I got to just leave the environment, which was very essential. I needed to experience just stepping away from everything and live a different life.
Mm. A different life.
Yeah, I lived a different life, like literally from an office job to like manual labor. Yeah, coming back, I was a lot clearer on what I was and not willing to compromise on.
Mm.
And that's why now, you know, I'm maybe moving on to the next lesson that I've learned is the value of physical and mental health.
Oof.
Yeah, I've become quite obsessed about it. And I can't emphasize this enough. I think you also are a firm believer of it, but there's certain, you know, foundations that are essential that are part, you know, to live your best life.
Yeah, to enjoy it.
Yeah. And one is sufficient sleep. Mm-hmm. Second, I don't know if you choose nutrition or exercise, but I think sometimes exercise informs nutrition. So then I'd say exercise.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, nutrition and having social relations in your life. Those are key ingredients, to be well.
I love that you put sleep is actually the bedrock.
It's the foundation.
Excuse the pun. It's the bedrock. But, like, students don't sleep, Naira.
Yeah.
Students don't sleep.
They don't.
And it is scary.
Yeah.
Like, how are you going to pass?
Yeah.
In fact, I take that back. How are you going to be valuable without consolidated, clear thinking?
Yeah.
Because sleep, that's what clear thinking requires.
Yep. And that's where all your memory gets consolidated. Everything you've learned in the day happens, you know, in deep sleep, in REM, all of that.
There's a lot of science that, guys, go search up. Do you know Andrew Huberman?
Yes, I love Huberman Labs.
His podcast is amazing. Search up Andrew Huberman. Andrew, Huberman. This is not sponsored, by the way. Search up that name and then search up sleep. I promise you it might just change your life. Because I think a lot of it is just not understanding.
Yeah.
Like, we just don't know.
Exactly. We don't. You know, you just think you want to be most productive. You've got this number of hours of in your day. Mm-hmm. And then if you just spend more hours studying, you'll be more successful and be more efficient when it's not the case. Mm-hmm. Because by sacrificing on sleep, you're reducing the productivity of your awake hours.
Yeah. And I think I even want to go back to what you mentioned about when you came to Ascension, you came to a great place of a great company of people. That's also another really big thing. There was this interesting pie chart that I saw, which was what success is. So this is what we think. On this side, we have what we think success is. And in the middle of this pie chart, it says hard work. Like, we think the harder you work, the more likely you are to succeed. That's all it is. But then there's the other side, which is what success really is. It's 25%, so a quarter hard work. It's another quarter who you work with, and the other half is what you work on. And like, just understanding that there is even more than just the hard work, there's also, in terms of mental health, like, who are the people that are with you in this journey? Because that's such an important but overlooked thing in like a student's journey. Like, you don't think studies is about people.
No. And then when you start working, you realize you spend more time with your work colleagues than anyone else in your life.
In your life.
Yes. More than your family, anyone, your friends. Your partner, your spouse. You will spend most of your time with your colleagues.
Imagine if you don't like your colleagues.
Yeah. That's just a miserable life.
It's a miserable life.
Yeah. What would you choose? Working a job that's boring with awesome people, or like an amazing job with like terrible people?
That's an interesting one, because if it's an amazing job, I don't think it has bad people. I think
okay, then let me just turn it around. Would you earn less working with better people?
That's a better one.
Or earn a truckload more money working with the worst people ever?
That is a good one. I'm not going to answer that, but guys, think about that.
I know a lot of people will choose money.
but like, it is such a, I think that's a pretty important question to just at least look at.
Yeah.
At least look at it. Because, you know, like, if we're thinking about what a career should be, it should be yours. It should be your career. And maybe there's some stage, right? Maybe there's a stage where you want to, because, yeah, when you're young, you just hustle. You want money, you want success, you want this, all that stuff. That's cool. But also think about, in the long term, would you carry on with the job that you're doing now for the next 10 years? Think about that.
Hmm.
Next one.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Maybe before I get into the next one, can I just add a few little tips on some of the health things that I mentioned? Just so that your audience knows. But I'm sure if you listen to Huberman, Huberman Lab, you'll get all the depth of info. Mm-hmm. But with sleep, I think it's important to have good sleep hygiene, which is like a regular sleep routine. Mm. Go to bed at the same time.
Set an alarm for bedtime, not just wake up.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And even keep consistent with it on the weekends. Yeah. And then also minimize screen time, and you must make sure that you wind down before bed to help facilitate better quality sleep. Also, light viewing activities before bed. A lot of people have bright fluorescent lights at night, and that really messes up with our hormones and, you know, circadian rhythm.
Yeah.
Yes, it confuses your body because light viewing has a massive impact on how our body responds and, you know, has a good sleep cycle. So I recommend very dim lighting at night. And obviously no caffeine.
Wait, that's not an obvious thing, Naira.
What, no caffeine? I would say after 12. I think, like, caffeine has a very long
12 p.m., ne?
Well, I don't know. It depends how sensitive you are to caffeine.
Also. But, like, literally the other day, Naira, like, I had someone else over for the podcast. And I always offer when I have people over for recordings, like, you want some water, coffee, tea? Just obviously, like, I mentioned coffee, like, I sort of just mentioned it as just to be polite, you know, just to offer. And he was like, I think it was about 6 o'clock in the evening. He's like, I have a coffee. And I'm like,
are you sure?
I'm going to the kitchen. No, look, have whatever you have. But clearly, people are having coffee just before bed.
I know. But if I was the person, I don't think I could allow someone to have coffee. I feel like I'd be like a mom and be like, sorry, no, that's not good for you.
Look, it's not
okay.
Me.
Okay. The people have the info. And then, like, from on a nutritional perspective, something that's quite important is, you know, a lot of people during, like, you're more alert during the morning hours. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of people may experience like a post-lunch slump,
mm-hmm,
or the itis. My colleague Lelo, she actually introduced me to the term the itis, which is that experience after lunch, that wanting to fall asleep. And just to let people know that a lot can be as a result of your diet and what you're actually eating that can cause like a glucose spike and drop. Mm-hmm. And it's the drop from that causes you to be sleepy.
Yeah.
So there's certain foods that you can eat and certain foods you can avoid to avoid having a slump so that you can have more productive hours in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of like carbohydrate-rich foods or anything that's going to spike your glucose, for example, potato, rice, bread, those are things that are very sweet sugar.
Yep,
that's
sugar.
Actually going to give you that's going to cause that slump, but you need to be able to keep your blood sugar levels more stable so that you can do through you know, protein, you know, vegetables, those kind of things. So just bear in mind that the way you feel is not just necessarily normal, it's as a result of our diets. So if we start like re-looking at that, it can make a big impact in terms of your productivity. That's stuff that I only like started learning about and implementing recently. So my whole life I just thought it's normal after lunch you feel like sleepy and you're unproductive, and then it's something recently that I learned and I started implementing, and now for work I try and avoid, you know, carbs and heavy carbs. I only eat protein and veggies specifically so that I can be productive in the afternoon.
And that's huge, because like there's a lot of things that we just take for granted and just assume, like we assume that you're meant to be tired after lunch. Okay. Might be the carbs, guys. It might be the carbs, but I think I encourage people to go and check it out. Even Huberman, he search up Andrew Huberman glucose spike. I'm sure you'll probably find something, and you'll see, like, go on YouTube, guys. There's experts in these fields that are giving us crazy, crazy insights.
Yes, this actually makes me think of an episode, Steve Bartlett, Diary of a CEO.
With the glucose goddess.
Yeah, that one is
that
a
must.
That
was amazing.
Yeah, it's called something about the glucose goddess. You need to listen to that, and then you will revolutionize your diet after that.
Glucose is a okay. Guys, go check it out. But just to add a last thing before you get onto your next one, glucose is it's the energy source for all functions in the body, and your brain needs it especially. Your brain it can chow up to like 25% of all your calorie needs. Your brain needs a lot basically, and glucose is the fuel. If you have glucose spikes, you are messing with your energy levels in general. And those are caused by, as what Nair has already mentioned, high carb-rich foods, sugars and things. You'll find that if you just have a little bit less bump at lunch, if you have a little bit less bread at lunch, you'll probably have more energy throughout. So just maybe try it. Try just to take out the carbs from lunch. You might see a difference.
Yeah, and she has all interesting hacks, but you can listen to her. Something about, you know, consuming vinegar water.
Is it apple cider vinegar?
Any type of vinegar. Yeah, diluted in water. If you consume that before a meal, it reduces your glucose spike quite significantly.
Also, the order of eating vegetables and then eating the carbs. Yes.
So if you've got a plate of protein, carbs, and some vegetables on your plate, the order of eating is if you start with your vegetable before the rest of the meal, you will also slow down your glucose spike because there's fiber in vegetables, and that slows down the release of glucose into your blood system.
Oh, yeah. That reminds me of the whole fruit conundrum that we have.
Oh my god. After I listened to that, I said I won't drink fruit juice again.
rather fruits than fruit juice, rather whole fruits, because the problem with the fruit juice is there's no fiber that blocks the glucose from going straight into your blood. But yeah, we're getting a bit technical into that.
Now we're just going on to this health topic, but I think you can tell I'm very interested and obsessed about health and wellness. It's really important. But yeah, there's so many things out there that can improve you know, everyone's life, everyone's productivity. But yeah, let's move on. The other, you know, thing that I've experienced is
to be continued in part 3. See you next week.